Hello, everyone, and welcome to End of Life University Podcast, where we share real talk about life and death. I'm your host, as always, Dr. Karen Wyatt, and I want to thank you for joining me here today for episode number 325. Today, in a few moments, I'll be sharing with you an interview I did with Dr. John Mulder, a palliative care physician. And I really enjoyed this conversation, doctor to doctor, talking all about palliative care. I think you'll enjoy listening in as well, so stay tuned. In just a moment, we'll get to that. But first of all, I have a couple of new supporters on my page at patreon.com/EOLU. Monica Zaplinski and Jeannie Canepa. I want to thank you, Monica and Jeannie, for signing up and joining the team and offering a bit of financial support on a monthly or annual basis to keep this podcast on the air. And also thank everyone who's been contributing for several years now to help me with the financial expenses of the podcast. And I wanted to mention, I have had several requests to begin offering transcripts of the podcast, which I think is a great idea, and I'm very happy to do that. Just that it does cause a little greater expense for me in terms of producing the podcast. So I've decided to make it a bit of an incentive here. And when I get 25 more supporters on Patreon, I will start adding transcripts every week for every podcast. And I'll even go back and do some of the old podcasts as well, as I'm able to. So just a little incentive out there, 25 more patrons on my page at Patreon, patreon.com/EOLU. And you can sign up for just as little as $2 a month. And then I'll add on those transcripts for you as soon as we reach that goal. So with that being said, I will move on to the interview with John Mulder. And as always, stay tuned afterwards. I'll come back for a few takeaways and to say goodbye. So here we go. Today, I'm very happy to welcome my guest, Dr. John Mulder. Dr. Mulder is a pioneering member of the palliative care specialty. Currently, he is the chief medical consultant for hospice and palliative care at Holland Home in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He serves as executive director for the Trillium Institute, is the director of palliative medicine for the Michigan State University College of Human Medicine, medical director for palliative care at Metro Health, University of Michigan Health, and Program Director for Mercy Health Grand Rapids Palliative Medicine Fellowship Program. He is also a member of the Board of Directors for the data analytics firm Acclivity Health. Dr. Mulder, John, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, Karen, I'm delighted to be here. You left the two most important things off of my resume, however, a proud father and grandfather.
Ah, yes, yes. I definitely need to add those. And I wanted to say, after I'm tired just after reading your bio, because it sounds like you're very, very busy.
I have a lot of things that I love to do, and somewhere along the way have figured out how to keep a lot of balls in the air without letting them hit the ground. I feel very blessed. I feel like I have been gifted with many opportunities to serve. And when called upon, if I feel it's within my wheelhouse, I'll do it. And so far, I haven't been disappointed yet.
Well, I know that you began your medical career in family medicine, as did I. And I'm curious to know what inspired you to choose palliative care eventually as a specialty.
Well, that's a great question, Karen. Going back to medical school days, my dad was diagnosed with stomach cancer. It was Memorial Day of my third year of med school. And he died on Memorial Day of my senior year, so about 5 days before I graduated. And the last 6 months were very, very difficult for him and for the family. He suffered a lot of symptoms that were not well controlled, very poor communication with us, and so we really didn't have a lot of idea what was going on. As you may remember back to your medical school days, when you're a medical student, everybody believes that you are the expert in everything medical. And so my family continued to look to me for answers that I didn't have. So he died, I graduated, I moved on to my family medicine residency. And upon getting out of residency in 1983, my goal is to, you know, get into a small town, gather a lot of young families, and grow old with them. That was my ideal. And I started out on that road, and about a year into my practice, I was asked to serve on the board of a local hospice. Now, you recall that the hospice Medicare benefit was voted into law in 1982, but didn't really become activated until about 84. So this was a very new concept. Didn't know much about it, but I agreed to do that and sort of really was captivated by the concept. Of course, a lot of that was wishing that I'd had that when my dad was sick. And as the years went on, I transitioned off the board, and then they asked me to serve as their medical director. So I served as a hospice medical director part-time in the midst of my full-time family medicine practice. And frankly, I loved both of them. There was aspects of both that I really felt that were well-suited to my skill subset and to my personality. But along the way, I found myself more and more drawn to the palliative side and to the hospice side. I would go to the medical conferences, and I would be drawn to the end-of-life conversations and the symptom management lectures and things of that sort. And there were groups of us that were doing this nationally and sort of began to coalesce and, you know, began discussing what would this look like if we were able to have our own specialty in this area. And that culminated in the formation of the American Board of Hospice and Palliative Medicine in 1997. And I finally sat for the board myself in 2000, and once that happened, I found myself, again, more drawn to it, and I accepted an invitation to do this full-time down in Nashville, Tennessee. So had the opportunity to work with a large hospice down there and then also teach at Vanderbilt University, got connected with some hospital systems in Nashville and helped them to develop their palliative care program. So a lot happened there in the early 2000s. You know, it was, at the end of the day, I would be contemplating the offer for this full-time job, and I realized, you know, if I weren't there at the end of the table delivering a baby, someone else would keep the kid from hitting the floor. And if I was not looking at that red ear, someone else would make sure that the kid got his amoxicillin. But if I were not at the bedside of that dying patient, nobody would be. There just wasn't that many of us to do what it is that I was doing. And that's really what prompted me to do it full-time. And so it's been 21 years of full-time work, and I've not looked back. About 6 years after I went down to Nashville, so this would be 2006, I was invited by Holland Home to come to Grand Rapids. Holland Home is a very old, not-for-profit, faith-based organization, been around since 1892. And they were in the process of developing a hospice and wanted me to help them to develop that. Had just opened an inpatient hospice unit that they wanted some assistance with. And so probably more relevant was that my kids had stayed in West Michigan. They were getting married and having kids of their own, so it seemed about right that I should come back to West Michigan. So I've been here for 21 years, and I did help them with the hospice, which is now thriving. We went from a census of 60. We're over 300 now. We did develop the inpatient hospice unit to be a successful community resource. Worked with a couple of different hospital systems to start their palliative care programs, and we started our fellowship program up here, which has been really wonderful because it allows me to continue in the educational realm, both with medical students through my role with Michigan State and now with the postgraduate learners in wanting to establish their role in specialist care in hospice and palliative medicine.
I love that you shared your recognition that someone else could take your place in family medicine, but that no one else would be there to take your place in hospice and palliative care, because I had somewhat the same thought myself as I was going back and forth between hospice and palliative medicine and recognizing, because I'm comfortable with end-of-life care and I don't know anyone else who is, it feels like that's the most important place for me to be because I can do it. Somehow I resonate with it, and somehow it feels beneficial to me as well to be working in that end of life area. So similar to you, I made the decision that that was really the best place for me to put my energy.
I thought it was kind of strange as I look back on my career. You know, back in the 80s, I was chief of medicine at our local hospital, and I lobbied an internal medicine group to see if they would be willing to take care of my practices. I think at the time there were six of us in the practice to take care of our patients inpatient. We didn't like being in the hospital, didn't want to be in the hospital, and so created what could have been one of the first hospitalist services, even though we didn't have that term at the time. And so fast forward 20 years, now I'm into the field of hospice and palliative medicine, and the thing that I love most is being in the hospital with these seriously ill patients. And I thought, golly, that just seems to be a 180 reversal of, because I just couldn't wait to get out, and now I can't wait to get in. And I think it really relates to that passion of knowing that we're at the bedside of someone who we can help live better, feel better, and just bring some really meaningful quality into their life.
Mm-hmm. That's so very true. And I want to talk to you about, I think, the current state of palliative care and maybe where we're headed in the future. But I thought we should begin with just the very basic question of the differences between palliative and hospice care, because no matter how many times we talk about it, almost every day I still meet people who have no idea that there is a difference between hospice and palliative care. So I think we can't talk about this too much. So if you wouldn't mind reviewing that.
I absolutely agree. And I have the same experience. And part of the challenge is, of course, you know, hospice is, you know, centuries old, probably millennia old in terms of just the concept of taking care of the dying and bringing comfort and meaningfulness into their life. And by the way, you may be aware, if you've done much international work, the distinction is not nearly as important in other countries as it is here. So hospice really formally got on its feet here in the United States in the mid 70s, and then when the funding stream came through in the early 80s, now you had a very specific organizational structure. If you want to get paid, here's what you need to do. You need to have this team in place, including the nurse, the social worker, the chaplain, the medical director, volunteers, and other ancillary providers and therapists as might be relevant to the patient. And the hospice will get paid a per diem amount every day that a patient is in. There are specific eligibility criteria that are prognostically based. And the team then provides the care for this patient who, if the disease runs its normal course, would be expected to die within 6 months. And so that really is the genesis of our end-of-life focus. Palliative care then grew out of that, recognizing, well, why would you have to be terminally ill to start receiving, sophisticated and complex symptom management? But because that was in the realm of the expertise of the hospice doc. And so, you know, through that period of the 90s where we started stretching out and saying, well, we can take care of people, just not in the context of the hospice team or the hospice infrastructure. And so we started seeing these little tentacles coming off, these little branches of palliative services being developed, both in the community and in the hospital system. But there still was this heavy tether between hospice and palliative providers. And in fact, many circumstances, the palliative providers themselves were employed by hospices. So again, some of the confusion is natural. I'm very pleased that over the last 10 to 15 years, particularly through the efforts of the Academy, our Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine, through the Center for the Advancement of Palliative Care, CAPSI, who have really looked at focusing on the importance of palliative care as an independent discipline. So I describe it to folks that my specialty, palliative medicine, is not a lot different than other medical subspecialties. You have seizure disorders and things like that. You might go to see a neurologist. You have a rash. You might go to a dermatologist. You have complex symptom issues, and with an advanced illness, you go to see the palliative doc. And I don't talk at all about prognosis as far as eligibility to receive palliative services, because there's really no such thing as eligibility. You don't have to be eligible to go see a cardiologist or a gastroenterologist. You just need to have an issue that they might be able to address, and the doc sends you over there. So we exist as a tertiary medical specialty that offers a complex symptom management, and I refer to it as strategic planning. I help folks that have these complex illnesses plan what their life is going to look like. And I do that through a values-based approach. What is sacred to you? And how do we clear the path for you to achieve joy and peace and to be able to do the things that are meaningful for you in life. And so palliative care, much broader to be able to encompass people that have any sort of advanced illness or chronic illness that carries a symptom burden or the need to plan for what lies ahead. Hospice is a very specific team-based approach to someone who has a prognosis of 6 months or less and needs the type of services that the hospice team would deliver. So that's not exactly the elevator speech, but that's kind of how I distinguish those.
I think that's great. And palliative care removes the issue that I think is the greatest stumbling block in hospice, which is that eligibility criteria, because it's very difficult to give someone a diagnosis of 6 months. In so many situations, doctors are not willing to say this person has 6 months or less to live, which is the reason why patients don't get referred to hospice until maybe the last week or two of life. And they're going without care that would have been beneficial to them for much, much longer time. And so it's really frustrating when you work in hospice to see that there's so many people who can't receive the benefits of that care just because of that criteria in hospice. And palliative care completely alleviates that problem by removing that prognostic criteria. And I think that's we need.
Exactly. And the questions that I ask are, what's going on and what do you need? I don't say, how long do you have to live? It's what's going on and what do you need? And then sometimes we'll parlay that into whatever resource is necessary. And typically it's not that difficult to get the patient to understand if this is what they've identified as their needs, then I can identify the resources that are going to best meet those needs. Might be hospice, but quite often it's not.
Yeah. And that's exactly the right question to begin with, just in order to decide where to send the patient and the very best way to meet their needs. But lately, I've been reading some editorials talking about, for both hospice and palliative care, that maybe both of them need to be rebranded and even renamed. Some people are suggesting, let's get rid of the names hospice and palliative care altogether so that we can change people's perceptions by rebranding. And I'm curious what you think about that. Do we need new names, or do we just need to change people's perceptions?
Well, you know, Facebook just changed their name to Meta. We'll see how that works for them.
Yeah.
You know, I think there are good reasons for changing names and there are bad reasons for changing names. And I think that when you are changing names because you're trying to get rid of a tarnish, that's not always successful. If you're changing the name because you've got a new approach, a new focus, a new paradigm that you're looking at, then that makes a lot of sense to me. Just as an aside, you know, Holland Home, when you listen to that word, you say, what on earth do they do? That was the name that was given to us 129 years ago. And it was a bunch of Hollanders living in Grand Rapids, Michigan, that bought a house to take care of 8 elderly folks in their congregation who needed some additional care. We looked at name changing a decade ago, and because we didn't like the name, but at that time it's 120 years old. Is it time to get, you know, freshen it up a little bit? They found that the name recognition and value of that term in the community was so strong, they said, you don't want to change the name. You know, change the logo if you want, but don't change the name. I think that over the last, I've been in this field for over 30 years, and, you know, they speak of the challenge of using the H word. You know, you can see my mom, but don't use the word hospice. Mm-hmm. So I think that, quite frankly, we have evolved from that. There still is a lot of misunderstanding, and that's why I appreciate you asking the question about the difference between hospice and palliative. There's still a lot of misunderstanding about that in the community. But I think that we've become so much more integrated that that we don't see the you know, abhorrent knee-jerk reaction to the use of the word hospice. I think that It's in the hospital now, the social workers, discharge planners, and even the attending physicians are becoming much more comfortable not saying, hey, there's nothing else we can do, so we're going to go to hospice. Do you want to live or do you want to go to hospice? I mean, there's all sorts of really tragic ways that that's been used in the past, and we're just not seeing that anymore. So I think there's been a gradual greater acceptance. In terms of the word palliative, we as an organization have looked at this. We as a specialty have looked at this for, the couple of decades that I've been actively involved in the kind of the new paradigm of palliative care. And nobody has really come up with something that is meaningful, descriptive, and does what the word palliative does. My own bias is that I think we can continue to make the word palliative work. If you look at the advancement of palliative resources in the hospital and in the community over the last decade in particular, it's exploded. You can't find a hospital now that doesn't have some element of a palliative resource or service. Might be some rural communities that haven't done that yet, but certainly in every significant city and in any hospital of any size, has some sort of a palliative initiative. It might be a full-fledged program, multidisciplinary, lots of team members, or it might be a nurse practitioner who is seeing folks that are having complex issues. But I think that it more and more is being accepted, and I think that rather than changing the name, we continue to market what it is we actually do, because people love what we do, people need what we do, and if the only issue is the impression, the kind of a negative impression that that they have because it was so long associated with death and dying and a few days left on earth. And I think that we're going to be more successful than trying to change the name and doing a huge marketing campaign to try to pivot in that way. I just don't see it. I understand it. I've been part of those arguments and conversations. I don't mind the words. Every time I see that someone is misusing it or not understanding, I just clarify it. But I'm only one person, and hopefully as a discipline we can make some inroads there.
I think that's a really good point. And my concern about changing the name is then you would almost be starting at square one, trying to educate people about the new name now and what this means and why we're using it. And it feels like what we need is to educate people anyway. So let's just keep the name. And because there are already people, as you said, who are beginning to accept it and understand it, let's start where we are right now and keep moving forward with what we have rather than starting all over again and trying to get people used to something, calling it something different. Yeah. But I'm wondering what you're seeing in our profession with our colleagues in other specialties, because I know in the past I've encountered some resistance from some specialists to referring patients to palliative care. And are you seeing that change?
Well, that's a yes and no. I once had a couple of really quick vignettes. I had a colleague that came up and said, I really admire what you do. I could never work in a specialty where all my patients died. And I waited for a second to see if he would understand the idiocy of what he had just said. And when he didn't, I said, well, I would love to shadow you sometime in your office and meet some of these patients who are never going to die. And he sort of chuckled and said, yeah, well, you know what I mean. And I said, exactly, I know what you mean. And that's the problem. Because of the fact that you don't understand and acknowledge the fact that your patients are going to die, you miss opportunities to bring resources into their lives that might help them. I had another one, and this was probably more to your point. A doc said, I've got someone I'd like you to see. I just don't think they're ready yet. And I said, my job is to relieve their burden of suffering and improve their quality of life. Help me understand when someone is not ready for that. And, he thought about it, long pause. And I know what that long pause was, because he thought that what I did was end-of-life care. And so we have those folks because that's the environment that they grew up with. I was on a planning call just a month or so ago, when we were talking about education, and the folks, I was the only physician on the call, and they were talking about advanced planning and end of life resources and things of that sort. And someone was on a kick; they wanted to have it as part of licensing. state licensing requirements that would require docs to have CME in some aspect of advanced care planning, palliative care, things of that sort. And I said, I think it's a waste of time and money because those that get it, want to know it, are already doing it, and they'll be enthusiastic. They don't need a requirement on their license to make them do that. Those that really have no interest and those who are kind of disenfranchised from the concept are going to find some way to check a box and move on with life as it is, and it's not going to be integrated. If you're really interested in changing the paradigm of care, you need to recognize, and this is a very simplistic overview, but I think it's relevant. The old guard, those that are already in practice doing what they do, are going to continue to do what they do. They might look over their shoulder and see this movement of hospice and palliative care, but may never really find it relevant to their population or how it's going to help them until they themselves or family member needs service. And then they'll change. The younger folks, and I interact with medical students, residents, and fellows all the time, and I'm absolutely thrilled with the responsiveness that they have to when you teach palliative care as a normal part of the medical care system, and they come into their clinical realm with that understanding, with that background. They look for it, they see it, it's natural to them. They then learn how to how to integrate it. And I realize that I might be a little more fortunate than some places because we have systems that we've developed here so that it's a required rotation for every student that comes out of Michigan State University here in Grand Rapids and in East Lansing. If they are in med school, they will have a clinical rotation in palliative medicine. We've been very careful about picking the faculties so we know that they're going to have a good experience. It'll be a meaningful experience, and it's going to be a positive experience for them. So we're seeing a great uptick in interest in the field. But more than that, we're seeing them normalize that within their care realm. So that's on the younger side. That's the encouraging part. The older ones, I don't think we're going to make much headway with. And then we've got this large group in the middle. They're a little bit more adaptable because although they might have established a paradigm of care, that may or may not have involved some aspect of palliative or hospice in it, they are more likely to be involved in the services where the medical students and residents are in there, and they learn from them. And so I think that to an extent, the younger folks can teach kind of the middlings and influence it in that way. You know, you can go the old-fashioned way and incentivize that. I'm not sure exactly when you started your medical training, but I know that in my early days in practice, I saw a lot of things that became normalized. It used to be the domain of the physician. You know, it might be insulin dosing regimens. It might be vancomycin dosing regimen. A lot of pharmacy-related things that we handed over to specialized teams within the hospital. Wound management. All you have to do is just write wound management, and I don't have to worry about is it wet or dry or what I need to do with it, you know? And so we've developed a lot of specialized services and resources for certain disease states. And also now you've started to see payer sources who will bundle and will give you, you know, X amount of dollars for caring for this particular condition. You figure out how to spread the money around. And when folks have a financial incentive for engaging palliative in hospice, they're much more likely to do that. I'm not a fan of that, but if it works, I'm okay with it. I think that you want to develop the processes of doing it for the right reason. But if money pushes people into the right reason, then I guess I'm not totally opposed to that paradigm.
And I don't know if this is an idea in my head somehow that if more physicians would refer patients to palliative care and just, I mean, actually associate with a palliative care team, actually get feedback and hear from them how their patient's doing or what they're offering for their patient, I feel that we may see less burnout in medicine because it's very gratifying to work with patients when their overall needs are being met, when you're not just writing a prescription for them or sending them off for a treatment. But when you can recognize that this patient is actually having better quality of life and living their best life, that's very satisfying. You know, no matter what illness you're dealing with, it's satisfying to see that for your patient. So I feel like we could make an impact on burnout by spreading palliative care more.
I absolutely agree. One of the lectures that I developed about a decade ago that I've done a few times, I think the title is Integrating Palliative Care into Mainstream Medicine. And I have a handful of slides in the middle. The first one is benefit to patients. The second couple of slides is benefit to the hospital. And then the last couple of ones are benefit to physicians. And I go through why it is that their lives will be better, you know, by having palliative engaged with their patients. And that's what we find in reality. I work clinics in cancer centers, and the oncologists have come to very, very greatly appreciate what the palliative service can do for them, as well as what they do for the patients.
I was thinking maybe we should just talk a little bit about the benefits of palliative care for patient outcomes and quality of life, particularly for anyone listening out there who needs to bolster their own understanding of palliative care, because maybe they're trying to educate someone in their family or someone they work with about palliative care. So would you maybe review what's in those slides about the benefits for patients?
I'll give you a couple of very pragmatic examples beyond what's just the bullet points in the slides. The first one, it relates to the work that I used to do when I ran an ALS clinic. When the hospital system came to me and said, hey, you know, our musculoskeletal doc is leaving. I know that you've worked with her. Would you be willing to come in and run our ALS clinic? And I said, I'd be delighted to. I said, you realize, of course, that I'm not a neurologist. And they looked at me and said, yeah, but they don't need a neurologist. They've been diagnosed. They need what you have to offer. And what they recognized was what I was doing is I'm taking these folks from the beginning of their illness. They have a diagnosis of something that they know that they can't survive. And we don't know if it's going to be 6 months, a year, 5 years, whatever it's going to be. And that in my first visit with them, which is going to be a couple of hours, I walk through precisely what it means to have this diagnosis and the types of things that they're going to be encountering along the way. I then outline to them what it is that that we as a clinic, me as a palliative provider, but we as a clinic, are going to provide for them in terms of adaptation to the progressive functional decline, you know, sophisticated symptom management so they will feel well. But most importantly, and I do make this the most important thing, ongoing open communication about what's going on, what it means, what the alternatives are, what the options are, what they can expect to experience, and how we can help them navigate and negotiate this particular step of the way. So we have this open communication channel that that exists from the time they come in to the time that they die. And that is, I think, the epitome of what what would palliative providers do when they're integrated into a medical system. And I think that was successful. When I finally handed off the reins, I actually handed it off to a neurologist who happens to also have completed a fellowship in palliative medicine. And so I feel very comfortable with how that particular clinic is going to be managed. Not only that, but he runs Parkinson's clinic and some other neurodegenerative clinics as well. So I think that is, to me, is a really good example of what that ultimately looks like. And that the neurologists that exist within that neuroscience center are very well aware of the benefits of palliative care within that system. I remember the first time that I started working at a cancer center, which was in 2001, and the oncologists there had no use for me, quite frankly. We set up the clinic in a university center because we'd gotten a grant to do so. I got $500,000 to do this, and they just sort of said, yeah, whatever. And then one of the oncologist sent me someone who I think you'll smile at this, was having pain related to their cancer and was addicted to opioids. The patient was on Norco, 5 milligrams every 4 hours as needed. That was it. No indication as to what the, you know, what this doc thought was going on relative to substance abuse disorder. But, you know, within a very short matter of time, we got the pain tweaked, feeling well, went back to his doctor. And just the simple question was, why didn't you send me to him earlier? Because he got my pain under control so quickly. Essentially chastising the doc for not taking, you know, advantage of this resource. And quite frankly, he was sort of embarrassed that I was able, and sort of, I think, surprised that I knew something he didn't about managing something about cancer. Well, that was an early tipping point that now they started referring the patients to me. And what we found, kind of my favorite one, was a patient that came in who was had a young man in his, mid-40s, who had widely, diffusely metastatic melanoma and had failed pretty much every trial that had been given, every standard therapy that had been given. And when I saw him, he was exhausted, he was beleaguered, he had pain, he had intractable nausea and vomiting. He just was a mess. A lot of anxiety, a lot of distress in the family. And so, you know, nothing else I can do. I guess I better go see John. And so the first thing I did was to get him engaged in hospice. He clearly met the prognostic criteria. And I told him, I said, you know, we need to get your symptoms under control. And I think that maybe having a nurse come on out and meet with you on a regular basis, communicate with me. You live 40 miles from the cancer center. I hate you having to make this drive. Let's do that, and we'll get the symptoms under control. They liked that idea. I said, you know, I'm really the anxiety and the emotional distress in this room is palpable. And I think maybe having a social worker work with you guys to help get that under control would be of value as well. They agreed. They thought that was great. And then they said, and I said, you know, you've commented about your discouragement and your spiritual angst and, you know, kind of where was God when I needed him sort of questions that you're asking there. And so I'm thinking that maybe if I had a chaplain to kind of sit down and kind of help you work through some of those spiritual issues, you'd find some benefit there. And they agreed. And they kind of looked at me and says, you know all these people? And I said, yeah. And I said, they all work within the context of a hospice team. And you know, back to the previous part of our conversation, when they heard the word hospice, they just, you know, threw their hands up and said, oh, no, we can't do that. We're not ready for that. And I told them, I said, you know, I'm not sure that what your experience with hospice was or is or what your understanding, but what I've just described to you is what they do. And I'd like you to give it a chance just to see if we can't get you feeling better and functioning better. And then we'll reassess. And, you know, so it didn't take long. You're well aware. You get some good symptom management, you know, in place, and people start eating better, and you know, they start functioning better, and they're just, you know, life becomes more meaningful. Well, after about a month, I saw the guy and his wife, and he looked, golly, 100%, but he looked well, and he looked despite the diffuse disease he had. He said, you know, my oncologist had said there was one more trial that I could enter, but he didn't want to put me in it because he thought I was not in very good shape. Would you be willing to send me back to see him? I said, of course. I'm not going to stand in the way of a possibility of, you know, helping you do better. And we talked about it, and he had no illusions because he'd failed so much before, but we sent him back. And the first thing that was amusing to me was that the oncologist was just floored as to how well he looked simply by getting symptoms under control. Felt that his functional status was good enough to actually receive the experimental therapy, which he did. And wouldn't you know that it worked for him? And he saw not only that the progression stopped, but he actually had regression of some of the metastatic disease. So he continued that for a period of time. He and his wife actually had another baby during this period of time. And he lived for years beyond that, simply because we got his symptoms under control. Now, we did that through the hospice vein, as, you know, I sometimes tell people hospice saved his life, you know. Of course, just nobody really saves a life. He just extended his life, but to the point where he had a very, very different life experience than he would have had hospice and palliative not been involved in his care. So I think that, you know, we will best be known by what we do and how people respond to this. And I know that the docs take notice of that. One of the very first hospital consults that I did years ago, it was a 21-year-old with Burkitt's lymphoma. As you're aware, Burkitt's is a curable disease in a young man. And he had come into the hospital with a lump on his neck, and they biopsied. It was positive for the lymphoma. They immediately started therapy, and I was consulted 3 weeks later to help to develop an end-of-life plan. I thought to myself, why am I doing an end-of-life plan on a young man with a curable disease? And when I got in there, he and his parents were distraught at the bedside, and he had had intractable nausea and vomiting since the therapy. And they said, there's no way that I can do this again. I can't complete this therapy. I'd rather die than go through what I've gone through in the last 3 weeks. To anticipate that over the next few months is just intolerable, so I'm ready to go. And I said, how about if we simply get your nausea and vomiting under control? And they said, well, they've tried everything. And I said, oh, no, they haven't. I can assure you that my toolbox for symptom management is bigger than theirs. And, you know, I had him eating his chicken nuggets, drinking his Coke the next day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, his parents were thrilled. He was thrilled, finished the therapy. Every time he came back in for his next round, the first thing they did was consult me so I could get him back on this concoction that I put him on to help to prevent his nausea and vomiting. And he's alive to this day, and that was a dozen years ago. And as he left the hospital after the first time, his parents said, we don't know how to thank you. And I said, you don't have to thank me. Thank your physician for getting me involved. That's all you need to do. Now, I know that the doc had no idea that's what was going to happen, but I want the family to show their appreciation to him for having palliative involved. That will have a bigger impact on his desire to refer in the future than anything else. If the family believes that his engagement in palliative resources for their loved one made the difference in his life. So I think there's all sorts of ways that we make that influence known.
That's so true. And I love that you have these stories to share, because I've been learning recently of the power of stories to change behavior, as opposed to sending, articles with lots of facts and statistics in them, which other doctors may or may not respond to, but stories, and particularly from their own patients, are evocative, and they inspire people to want to change and to want to hear that response again from another patient. So that seems like the very best way to change the behavior of our colleagues is just simply sharing these amazing stories.
I hope so. I hope it makes a difference. I think that, it's one small step at a time. I look over my shoulder and I see where we've been and where we've come. And so when you talk about, do we need to change the name? What about our workforce shortage and things of that sort that we are going to deal with in the specialty? I look at where we were and where we are. I think we certainly don't want to be complacent. But I wouldn't be discouraged because I think we have come such a long way in establishing ourselves as a specialty, in just in encouraging and empowering folks to be involved in this, both on a provider level, but also on a family level, to just encourage them that these are great resources that can make a difference in their lives. We at the Institute are engaged in a series of public service efforts, and we've worked with lifelong learning programs at local universities, which for the most part are older, curious, involved adults who just, they want to keep learning. And so I go in and I talk about this stuff, and I tell those stories, and it enlightens them to the fact that these are things you need to be asking for when you hit this point. And there's never a time I've done one of these lectures where someone in the class hasn't come up to me afterward or emailed me afterwards and say, wow, I didn't know, but I've got this going on, and that's what I need. And it's just, that sort of laying the groundwork for people to demand the services. And then on what we're doing with the medical students to be able to increase the supply side of the equation so that when they do demand it, we've got opportunities for them to be able to be served.
And that's something, that supply side, I did want to talk about that with, we're in the midst of the silver tsunami, they call it, of baby boomers, which I am one, but 10,000 of us turn 65 yep. every day. Mm-hmm. And so the need for palliative care is only going to grow exponentially over the next couple of decades. And do you have any thoughts about how are we going to meet that need? Do we need to change how we're providing care, or can we attract enough people into this specialty to meet the need?
I think that, you know, as I contemplate this, because, you know, I'm firmly entrenched in that same demographic as well. And I like to think that what we're doing with the med students is a step in that direction. One of the first things I tell them when I'm doing my work with them is my goal, I just want you to understand, my goal is not to make a palliative physician out of you. So you don't have to be worried somehow I'm trying to put a hook on you and drag you into my camp. But here's what I know, and this I know for certain, that there are some aspects about what we do in palliative medicine that are critical to every medical specialty. And what I want to do is to make sure that I'm instilling some values in you, some approaches to communication, some approaches to patient well-being, sensitivity, values-based things, that you can do and you can use wherever you go. And so I may only have a few hours with them. I might have a couple of weeks with them. But whatever I do, I want to make sure that I'm instilling in them the principles of palliative care so that they can hang on to that as they move forward with their careers. And I think that in a more sophisticated way, the concept of primary palliative care is going to be a big deal. So again, when I'm the we that I'm using now refers to the Michigan State University Division of Palliative Medicine, are partnering with the family medicine residency programs that are affiliated with them. There are 13 of them throughout the state. They also have 8 clinical campuses, and we're affiliating with them as well to make sure that there are clinical resources that are not only available but gradually be integrated as a normal part of their education, so that the family medicine docs that come out of these programs have been, maybe I shouldn't use the word indoctrinated or brainwashed, but either one is fine with me, because that's what I'm trying to do. So that they will be so comfortable with the types of conversations and simple symptom management protocols that they'll just normally integrate that into their practices wherever they go. That's going to take some of the burden off of having tertiary level palliative specialists, because there's not enough of us to go around. The work needs to be done. It doesn't need to be done by us. So I really believe that. And one of the more controversial things that I sometimes speak about is that I believe, and we certainly are seeing this in the evolution of our accountable care organizations, our clinically integrated networks, and even some payer sources who are developing their own end-of-life tracks without using Medicare-certified hospices. I think that we need to define what we do by the tasks that need to be completed and the skill set that is required to carry those out. Whether you call it palliative, quite frankly, I don't care. Whether you work within the context of a Medicare-certified hospice, quite frankly, I don't care. I want you to get those types of resources that are critical for you at these very vulnerable points in your life by the trained practitioners who are skilled to be able to carry it out, however that comes. So if that means that we need to increase our team of palliative nurse practitioners and some of the efforts to now create palliative as a subspecialty for physician's assistants, whatever we need to do to get these folks out there. I know that part of your listening audience includes end-of-life doulas, which I think is a tremendous resource to the community. I would love to see more of them. They can serve a very valuable role in helping people navigate and negotiate the end-of-life journeys. It doesn't always have to be the traditional model. I just want to make sure that the concepts are integrated throughout.
And I love that idea, because it's really that with palliative care and also with hospice care, what we're offering is to fill in the gaps that for for too long have been left in medical training and in the way we approach medical illness in our care. We're just filling in the gaps that have been there in order to offer better, comprehensive, whole person care
exactly.
to every patient. And so as long as we're filling in the gaps, we can do that in many different ways.
I agree. Absolutely.
So that gives me some hope that at least there's some creativity right now happening in how we think about it and how we're approaching end-of-life issues. Because I think you're so right. It needs to be patient-centered. It needs to be based on what are the needs of each patient that we can meet and not dictated by a payer source. That's
right.
The thing that I think has really limited what can be offered in the past is that it's all been based around Medicare and what Medicare will cover. And I think it's definitely time to move past that.
Amen. Absolutely agree.
So are there any other insights you can share with us about anything else that's new on the horizon in palliative care that you could tell us about?
I think that in terms of new in palliative care, but I would kind of look at the other ways in which palliative is being recognized and can be used and could potentially reach a broader market. And one of those has to do with, you see a lot of hospital systems, and again, these conglomerations of healthcare resources that go into ACOs or the accountable care organizations and other related types of things that are developing specific tracks for advanced disease management. People that are chronically ill and are slipping through the cracks and who are high utilizers of hospital systems and sometimes using ERs as their primary care office. And what these organizations are recognizing is that we can set up a plan for chronic and advanced disease management that use palliative practitioners, because that's a great place for them. They know how to navigate these issues and how to help the patients process their illness and work through the system. And I think that we'll see more and more opportunities for that. Now, that doesn't necessarily help us with the workforce, because if we have a limited number of folks coming out, then we're going to see greater dilution of that. I think that the goal is getting the right patient into the right environment. You had referenced in my intro the fact that I work with a company called Acclivity Health, which is a data analytics company. Their goal, quite simply, is to use sophisticated data analytics to try to identify people who have need for these services and work with the attending physicians and the healthcare systems to get them plugged into the right place at the right time. They found that these processes get people into palliative resources and to hospice resources earlier, allowing those practitioners and providers to more effectively deal with their issues earlier on. I think those are the sorts of things that we're going to see evolving and to become more more prevalent in our healthcare systems, where we see that hospice and palliative will continue to grow, especially the palliative side, because that is being more recognized. How we can creatively leverage that talent and those resources to serve more patients, the right patients. I mean, I can remember early in my days of doing palliative consults in hospitals, a meaningful percentage of those were saying, I think this patient needs hospice. Can you talk him into it? I don't do those anymore. We don't do those anymore because we've developed the systems that allow better recognition of those eligibility issues, how to have the conversations and get folks involved. I don't need to be the person to try to convince someone to go to hospice if they've had a good conversation about what's going on. Effective communication on the front end is going to help that. That's what we talked about earlier, the kind of the primary palliative care. So you teach the intensivists and the hospitalists about how to have the conversations with patients about the resources available to help them at this stage of their illness. Because we may not have any more curative options, but we've got lots of opportunities to help them with the next phase of life. So I don't need to be involved in those anymore. So we're seeing this gradual level of sophistication and focus on the things that we really do specialize in as palliative physicians. So I see that happening along with the integration of more primary palliative care. I see opportunities for palliative physicians outside of the norm as we get more involved in ongoing chronic disease management, advanced disease care. And I think those are going to be meaningful in the future. I think that the role of hospices will continue to be quite important. I also alluded earlier that we're seeing some dilution of that as integrated networks are setting up their own end of life resources and just sort of bypassing hospices. So I think that it's really important for those that are listening who are involved with hospice organizations to be aware of what's happening in your community with, for example, Medicare Part A. Because if hospices are not attuned to what's going on with that, they could find themselves excluded from large populations of older adults that need their resources. So they need to be involved with their payer sources. They need to be involved with their healthcare systems and find out what it is that they can do to help these organizations with their end-of-life planning and to be involved as much as possible.
And it does seem like we need community-based solutions that involve all of the major stakeholders in the community. It's going to take all of us to really deal with these end-of-life issues as we go forward.
Absolutely. You can have policies that are enacted at a large corporate basis. The care is delivered to the community. It's one-on-one. It's one patient with one provider. And so if we're not involved, then we allow those making decisions outside of the community to begin dictating what it is that we are going to end up doing. So we have to be involved.
Well, Dr. Mulder, it's just been great talking with you today about all of these issues. And my goal for this podcast is to be a source of education for people out there. And you've really helped with that today by just providing so much information about palliative care and where we might be headed in the future. And I'm really grateful that you've taken the time to talk with me.
Well, Karen, I appreciate the opportunity. As you alluded earlier, I love telling stories, and I think that they can be reflective in terms of and memorable. So I just really appreciate the opportunity to educate and to inform whenever I can. And I just appreciate you and this podcast series, and have really enjoyed the time together.
Well, I know you mentioned you're starting your own podcast. Do you want to tell us what that's called? Because maybe listeners would like to tune in and hear that as well.
Well, I'm shameless. I'll go ahead and put that out there. it'll be accessible through our website, which is trilliuminstitute.org, and it's spelled just the way it sounds. Trillium, like the flower. Trilliuminstitute.org, and the podcast is entitled Palliative Matters. And we've got the first two or three recorded. We've not posted them yet. We will be probably in the next couple of months. Your listeners can maybe jump onto the site or follow us on Facebook. Trillium Institute has has both Facebook and Twitter accounts, and you can follow us and be alerted when we finally do release those.
Well, that's fantastic. I think podcasting is a great way to get information out there. So good luck with that. And I'm going to link to that in the show notes for this episode so people can find you there.
Well, thank you so much.
So, all right. Well, take care. And hopefully we can chat again another time in the future and catch up on how things are going.
I'll look forward to that, Karen. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. John Mulder. I found it really delightful to talk with him and listen to the stories he has to tell about patients that he's cared for, and also discussing the idea that one of the ways we can motivate our physician colleagues to refer more patients for palliative care in a more timely manner is to tell them stories and to share these amazing patient stories with them so that other doctors who don't have the benefit or the experience of seeing what palliative care and hospice can do for people begin to learn about it, but also just get inspired by hearing stories. And Dr. Mulder has some great ones. I really wish he would do some writing to put that out there, but I'm glad to see that he's doing some speaking and also teaching with medical students and residents. I think that's really powerful. And one of the things he talked about for the future is the idea of primary palliative care, which would be teaching all primary care doctors palliative medicine skills so that we really expand the field of palliative care that's available to patients. We have many more doctors who've been trained in palliative care who can offer this whole person comprehensive care to their patients, regardless of where they are in terms of illness, life, and the end of life. So I felt really inspired after this conversation, and I'm hopeful for the future that we are going to be able to meet the needs of our population as we move forward in palliative care. So if you enjoy conversations like this, please subscribe to the podcast wherever you happen to be listening. Also, recommend it to other people who might benefit from becoming a listener. And once you subscribe, be sure to leave a rating and a review. That really helps us out in getting the podcast visible to more people who are searching for this kind of content, and also helping us grow the community of people who care about end-of-life issues. So until next week, when I'll be back with another interview for you, remember that we're here for love. So face your fear, be ready for whatever happens next, and love each and every moment of your precious life. Bye-bye.